began as demonstrations due to a falling currency has now turned into calls for the end of the regime. After 3 weeks, protests have now spread across Iran as the regime gears up to celebrate its 47th anniversary. With its regional proxies in retreat and Iranians on the street demanding regime change, this has now become the biggest test of the clerical regime. Is this the beginning of the end? Can the masses finally overthrow the regime, and what will replace it? And here to discuss everything is the Geopolicy founder, Adnan Khan. Pray you're well, Adnan.
Imran, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. Alhamdulillah. I want to remind all our listeners, everyone, that you can find us on all the major social media platforms where you can subscribe and never miss anything. So Adnan, let's start the discussion about Iran. And the first question is what everyone wants to hear is the Iranian regime about to fall or close to falling?
Yes, that is the million-dollar question. So I think, look, what should we be looking at? How can you identify that a regime is struggling, is on the verge of falling? And I think this is important because, in my opinion, I don't think we're going to see anything dramatic in Iran. I think this is going to be a bit of a long slog. And that's why I think it's important we're really looking at the right things. Now, you know, for the regime to fall, a number of things have to happen. The first thing is the protesters. What is their composition? Are we seeing people from different backgrounds, from different social classes, from different ethnicities? Are they coming out and they're protesting? And we're seeing some of that, but I don't think it's as widespread as being made out in the Western media. Secondly, are the protests geographically spread out? And this is actually quite important. Iran is a huge country. If protests are taking place across the country, it is going to spread the resources of the regime and their internal security services, and there's more likely chance that change can actually come. And this was one of the problems Bashar al-Assad had when the uprising started in Syria. He didn't have the forces to cover the length and breadth of the country. So as a result, he gave up parts of the country in order to focus on the core part of the country. And then the final thing, which is really important, is are the elites fracturing? If the elites, so the security services and the regime, if they start to fracture, then we're really talking about regime change. And this means the role of the military, the role of the security services is really, really critical. If they start to depart, if they start to leave, if they start to defect to the opposition, then really the regime is on its last legs. So I think for the moment, we're seeing the protests grow. We're seeing a clampdown by the regime. We are seeing them geographically spread. But we're only 2 weeks, between 2 to 3 weeks in here. The regime is absolutely huge. There's about 10,000 of them. The military, the IRGC, the security services, we're talking over 1 million personnel. So there's a long way to actually go here. So the composition of the protesters, the geographical spread, and the elites fracturing, these are really the key things we need to look at. And for the moment, the elites are actually quite united.
So Dan, how do we get here then? You know, why are things so bad? And, you know, based on what we've seen for the last number of weeks.
So the reason why things are so bad is in many ways, the regime in Tehran is no different to the USSR. Back in the 70s and the 80s. And in fact, there's actually a lot of similarities. So the Soviet regime had the KGB to monitor the people, to maintain security. And the clerical regime in Iran, they had the IRGC to do the same thing. The Soviet Union used repression, especially of minorities. And we see the same thing with the Iranian regime, with the Kurds, with the Azeris. The Soviets had a global project and everybody had to get in line. The clerical regime has a regional project and everyone has to get in line. In the Soviet Union, the Soviet Communist Party effectively controlled the economy. They were the elites. The clerical regime and their supporters, they controlled the economy. That's why we've got to where we are. So as far as most people are concerned in Iran, like they were in the Soviet Union, the regime just doesn't represent them. The regime just doesn't take care of them. People feel they can't live their life with dignity and survive because the regime is doing other stuff, which is lining their pockets. So this is why the regime in Tehran, in many ways, is like the Soviet Union was. And that's why it was inevitable we were going to get to this point. It was just a matter of time. And, you know, Iran effectively has protests every year. This is just the latest in a long line of protests that this country's seeing. And that's why things are so bad.
But in terms of the Iranian people themselves, how unified are they amongst them, one another against the regime? Because based on Western media, we're seeing they are polar opposites to the regime. But then, you know, I've seen also massive demonstrations which are pro-regime. So how do you, explain that aspect really?
So we need to understand Iranian society. The Iranian society has a population of 90 million plus people, about 92 million, and only 50% of them are Persians. The other 50% are minorities. So, you know, these protests are going to spread. They have to spread beyond the Persians and go to the minorities. So 25% of Iran's population are Azeris. So this is in the northeast of the country. In this part of the country, you have separatist areas. You even had a separatist movement over the years. So the regime deals with the Azeris in a very iron-fisted manner. Then next to the Azeris, you have the Kurds. They're about 10% of the population. So Mahsa Amini, the sister who was arrested for not wearing the hijab properly, and then she ended up passing away, she was Kurdish. Then 10% of the Iranian population is Baluchi. And so they're on the Pakistani border, Sistan, Balochistan. And the Iranian regime, again, deals with them in a very iron-fist manner. And there's been separatist movements over the years as well. And then about 5% of the population are Arab. So they live in the Khuzestan region, which is the oil-rich region. And the Arabs have never been happy that this area, which was called Awaz, has now been Persianized and it's called Khuzestan. So 50% of Iranian society is non-Persian. Only 50% is Persian. So there's these divisions that exist. Then you've got the urban-rural divide. So most of the support for the regime, it actually comes from the rural areas. So the pictures you see of English-speaking people who are not necessarily very Islamic, they've got an internet connection, they've got a telephone line, they can talk to the Western media. That's not really representative of most of Iran. Most people are not very well off and they can barely speak any other language other than Iran. So you have this rural urban divide, and then you've got the religious secular divide. So you've got the people in Iran who support the regime. They see themselves as Shia and they see the regime as their protectors. Then you've got people who are very, very secular, who are generally in the main cities, and they hate the regime. They believe their regime has completely taken the country backwards. Some of them support the Shah as well. So, you know, this is a society where you've got a lot of different elements. So if you want to overthrow the regime, you're going to have to unify across a lot of these fractures, which we're not seeing yet. So that's why once you start seeing that, then the regime's in trouble.
So, Adnan, 47 years for this Iranian regime. How have they managed to stay in power for such a long time?
So to understand this, we need to understand the clerical system or the system of governance that they set up. So the clerics, as we know, they came to power in 1979. There was an uprising against the Shah, who was a brutal dictator. He massacred the people. And different factions came together. And one of the unifying forces, the symbols of this uprising, was the clerics, led by Ayatollah Khomeini. So when they came to power, effectively, they became the political system. So today, you've got about 10,000 clerics who make up this system. They are the sole political party. They are the system. They take up the key positions. So one of the first things they did when they come to power is they didn't trust the army. The army was the Shah's army. So what they did was they established their own KGB, and that became the IRGC, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. So this is the most capable armed forces that they have. They have more capability than the actual conventional forces of Iran. And the IRGC has one job, is to protect and defend the regime. They do a lot of stuff abroad. They're the ones that established Hezbollah in Lebanon. Their primary role is actually protecting and defending the regime. And that's why if this uprising goes to its logical conclusion, the regime has prepared for this day. They've got the IRGC. So if the IRGC was to defect, it would be the end of the regime. Now, what the clerics did then, they established a political system. And what they established really was a hybrid system. The system in Iran is part theocratic and part electoral. And within this context, all sorts of views are permitted. So that's why in Iran, you have reformists, you have hardliners, you have conservatives. So the president the parliament and the assembly of experts are all elected. They all have terms. So the president of Iran, he was elected last year. He has a 4-year term. There's a 250 plus person parliament, which is elected every term. You have an assembly of experts, which is similar to the House of Lords in the UK. They check legislation. All of these are elected positions. Now, that might seem contradictory. How can you be a theocratic system where certain people have been ordained to rule and then you have elections? But that's the hybrid they've created. However, all of this has to be vetted by the Guardian Council. Now, the Guardian Council is a committee that is elected by the Supreme Leader, who's Ayatollah Khomeini at the moment. And what this council does, they disqualify most people. Every time there's an election, every time someone wants to stand for president, they actually disqualify most people. So the reason why this regime has survived for this long is they basically have monopolized the political system. They ensure that only clerics take up the key positions. But to keep the system going and to give it a degree of credibility, they allow elections and they allow alternative views, but again, in a very limited context. So the current president, he's not actually a cleric, but he's become the president. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, if you remember him, he wasn't from the core clerical establishment, but they realized they need to let a few outsiders come into these positions. Otherwise, people will start questioning the system. So like China, they have the Communist Party there, and like the Soviet Union, Iran, effectively the clerics are the sole political party.
Many reports have come out, and these reports have said that there's been a lot of attacks on places of worship, and the regime has killed many, you know, some numbering into the thousands. Do you think there's a foreign hand in everything what's going on in Iran at the moment?
Yeah, so there's definitely a foreign hand. And the reason why I say that is because a lot of these protests, they're actually arranged. There's a structure. People are at a certain place. And by the time the security services get organized, they've disappeared. They've gone somewhere else. So there's a level of organization here. Now, Israel's dream is to overthrow the regime. And historically, Mossad is, you know, it has agents in this country. This is something Israel has admitted. And in fact, this is something even the Iranians have admitted as well. We know, for example, when the 12-day war happened between Iran and Israel last year, the Israelis were able to take down their defense system, their missile defense system. They were able to launch drones from inside the country. That means they have an intelligence presence within the country. And Israel, to be honest, being very honest, it wants to overthrow the regime. The regime is the main competitor in this country. So, you know, Israel definitely, you know, they've got their agents on the ground. I mean, their agents could be Iranians who hate the regime. You've got, you know, they've recruited people who are Mossad agents. They've probably got Jews who have gone from Israel over there who are acting as though they're Iranians. So again, I mean, this isn't anything hidden. This isn't anything secret. This is actually a well-known. The thing which is a bit unclear at the moment is the CIA's role and America's role. Because America publicly is being critical of the regime, but you're not seeing that translate into definitive and wide-scale actions. So, you know, America could undermine the regime, it could weaken them, it could overthrow them. So what you're seeing is verbally they are criticizing the regime, but you're not seeing that translate into actions. And also, we've not seen symbols of the regime attacked yet, which is what you would do if you wanted to overthrow the regime. So this would be, we've seen some places of worship attacked. We've seen, for example, people in the streets take their hijabs off, but these are too small, really, in size to really have an effect. So, you know, if America and Israel are trying to overthrow the regime, it's interesting here. Are they both united in this? Or is Israel doing this without America physically on its side? And I think that's something we're going to have to watch because it's not really clear yet.
Even the West, you know, they seem quite sympathetic to the protesters and, you know, unified in the support for these individuals. And they are adamantly against the regime. You know, Donald Trump has said so many things, MEGA, you're being one of them, make Iran great again. Why would the West, you know, after all the sanctions and its role it's played, be unified with the people of Iran?
So for the moment, the West are verbally supporting the protesters, which is actually really funny because the Iranians have the right to protest. They have the right to change the regime. We didn't see any of this when the Palestinians in Gaza or the West Bank were protesting. In fact, when they protested, the Israelis were armed. They were given weapons. So it shows you the hypocrisy there. Obviously, look, Iran is a regional power and most of the West support Israel. And for Israel, Iran is their enemy. So they support Israel. They support Israel against their enemy. But we need to see what this means practically on the ground, because verbally they can say whatever they want. They may even say things and contradict themselves later. So we need to see if their verbal support for the protesters actually supports into practical support on the ground. Don't get me wrong, Israel's dream is to overthrow this regime. Israel is very clear, wants to overthrow the regime. Israel believes the Iranian people have the right to have their own regime, even though the people of Gaza, who technically are, you know, Israel's people, they don't have the right to have that. So, you know, definitely the West are supporting this. And I mean, that's the consistent position they've always had. They've always been anti-Iran. I think we're going to look at the American position. So I'm not sure really the American position, when they criticize Iran, in many ways you could argue what they're saying is actually helping the regime. The regime's narrative is all these protests are Western-backed. This is a Western game. And actually, the Iranian regime is defending the country against these imperialists. So when Donald Trump says, we support the protesters, they're like, well, there you go. We told you. We told you these protesters are not talking or protesting about some local issue. What they're doing is they're extensions of America. So we're going to really ask the question, when Trump says, I support the protesters, he's actually helping and aiding the narrative of the regime. And then the other thing you've got to keep in mind is, if Donald Trump is saying, we will arm and help the people of Iran, the way the regime will get around this is, okay, let's talk, let's come to a negotiation. So what Trump could be doing is he's trying to get more favorable terms. He's trying to push the regime in a corner so they come to the negotiation table. Until these protests don't get to a point where the regime's struggling, I can't see them really doing it. We've got to keep in mind that despite what America says publicly about Iran, they have worked together, Iran and America, on a number of issues in the region. In Iraq, America and Iran were on the same side. In Afghanistan, Iran and America were on the same side. In fact, America has been able to, despite all its rhetoric, been able to work with Iran on all these issues in the region. So I don't really think it would be in America's interest to get rid of this regime when actually, despite all their rhetoric, they're able to work together in the regime. However, look, America has interests. It doesn't love the Iranian regime. It'll be more than happy to get rid of them if it serves their interests. So, you know, Iran is on the north of Iran is on the Caspian. The Caspian is surrounded by Russia. America at the moment is in a battle with Russia. So for the Iranian regime to get overthrown, it would have an impact on Russia. I'm sure we're going to talk about this. If you do overthrow the regime, what's going to replace it? So the Western support for the Iranian people against the regime, this has been their consistent position. I think with America, we've got to watch what they do, because if what they're saying translate into action, then yeah, the regime's potentially in trouble.
In terms of the regime dealing with the protests and the protesters, how does it do it? What's their strategy?
So the regime are following a couple of key things. They're trying to be a bit more collaborated and targeted rather than being indiscriminate. They're trying to suppress the protest without triggering a massive escalation. So effectively, they're trying to contain, fragment, and deter what's going on. So really what they're trying to avoid is nationwide mass killings like they've done in the past. They do that, the world is watching, and it will probably result in the protesters spreading across the country. So specifically what we've seen is the targeted arrests of organizers, activists, and social media amplifiers. We've seen nighttime detentions, so people don't see the forces going around just mass arresting people. You've seen short-term disappearances rather than long prison sentences. And you're seeing the selective use of force, so batons, tear gas, pellet guns. And again, this differs from place to place. So what the regime's trying to do is they're trying to raise the cost of protests without trying to create martyrs. Also, look, if they go too far, you might get a fracture within the security services and the elite. And that's the last thing they want to do. So what the regime is betting on is fatigue, fear, and fragmentation. So they want to drag this out. And what you're seeing from the regime is some of them are saying, let's talk to the protesters. let's make some reforms. Then the hard Asians are saying, no, how dare they come on the street? They're Western backed. We have to come down on them like a ton of bricks. This is actually the only area of difference. The regime is generally unified that we got to deal with this. Where the difference is should we talk and negotiate or should we clamp down like we've always done? That's the only area of difference between them.
Going forward, what's next? You know, if these protests and the protesters are to succeed, what are the possible outcomes? And, you know, one of the names that is popping off and I'm hearing everywhere is Reza Pahlavi, the previous Shah's son, coming to power, who ironically is in America. So what should we expect if the protests succeed?
So firstly, a lot needs to happen for us to even get to this point. You got to keep in mind, you've got the IRGC, so you're talking about up to 200,000 security personnel. They have another 200,000 besieged forces. This is a paramilitary force who are, they purely exist to provide muscle on the streets. So, you know, for the regime to get overthrown, a lot has to really happen. But let's say it happens. So the IRGC, effectively, they are the Nusra of the clerical regime. They are the power. So what they could do, so unless they fracture, you're not going to overthrow the regime. So the IRGC could move to remove the clerics and they could take over themselves. And if they take over, two things can happen. They can either set up a dictatorship, which is what's happened in Iran's recent history. So you talked about Reza Pahlavi. His father was Mohammad Reza Shah. His father in World War I, he became a dictator. So they could set up a dictatorship and probably things will get even worse in the country. What the IRGC could also do is just set up a rump parliament to keep protesters happy. So you have a parliament, there's a lot of debate and discussion goes on, but the real power is the IRGC. So this is similar to Egypt and Pakistan, where the military is the power, but you have a parliament to give some sort of like image that, you know, people have a say in it. Now, uprooting the whole system is going to require united opposition, which just does not currently exist. It never has. The opposition in Iran and the opposition outside Iran, the dissidents, they've never been unified. And, you know, the point you mentioned about the former Crown Prince, Reza Shah, he has no credibility in Iran. He's not been in Iran for 50 years. No one actually knows, well, they know him. In fact, most people were born after him. He has no credibility in Iran. And even Trump has refused to meet him in America. So although he is quite active on social media, I think it's going to be very unlikely. He's got no support in the country. So I doubt that's going to happen. And this is probably one of the problems the protesters have got. Who's your face? So in 1979, when the revolution happened, Ayatollah Khomeini became the face. He became the symbol. You don't have that at the moment. And they're quite divided. The opposition, you've got monarchists who want the monarchy back. You've got people who just want to open democracy. You've got other people that want a dictatorship. You've got other people that want some form of Shiism, but without the clerics. So, you know, this hasn't been made clear yet. So until you don't actually see the fracture of the regime, it's not really the end of the regime yet. If you don't see the IRGC fracturing, if you don't see them defecting, then the end of the regime actually isn't here yet. I do feel, and I believe this, that in the medium to long term, the regime's days are numbered. You know, you mentioned we're coming up to 47 years in February for this regime. They run the economy into the ground. People have had enough of them. They went to war with Israel, where bombs dropped on Tehran. Their proxies are in retreat. This whole Shia agenda, people just don't buy it anymore in the country. So I think in the long run, they're basically done. It's just a matter of how long it will take now.
And going forward, you know, looking ahead, what should we be looking at?
So look, next door in Syria, the uprising happened for 13 years. Everybody thought Bashar al-Assad had won. And then in 2 weeks, he got overthrown. I don't think that's going to happen in Iran. Iran is a much larger country, much bigger population. And look, the IRGC, the supreme leader, the parliament, they're institutionalized. This isn't just something they've imposed on the country. People actually engage with the system through these institutions. So I think we got to look at this more in a long-term thing. I know it's getting a lot of coverage now and a lot of people think the regime might fall. I think we got to look at more from a long-term perspective. I don't think in the long term the regime will survive. I think the people absolutely hate the regime. and the regime that she failed the people. But until we don't see elite fracture, we won't see a divide amongst the regime, and therefore we won't see a collapse. So monitoring the elites, the clerics and the security services, that's what we definitely need to keep an eye on. We need to look at this more as a long-term thing rather than a short-term thing. If the conventional army is deployed on the streets, that means the regime is struggling. That means the IRGC have failed and the clerics feel a threat, so they've deployed the army now. So that's another thing to watch. Then the final thing to probably keep an eye on, outside forces. Look, America, Israel and the West, they could organize the opposition. They could galvanize them, they could structure them, which is what they did in 1979. And this would give people hope. If we start seeing that, then yeah, you know, we mean business here, and the regime potentially might struggle. So these are really the things to really keep an eye on.
Adnan, thank you for your time today. If you want to learn more about the issues that were raised today, please check out our website, www.geopolicy.com, which is all one word. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you will find comprehensive insights, analysis, and articles, along with deep dives. I'm Imran. Thank you for listening.